Thank you very much.
When I was thinking how to begin this speech, I remembered dancing with my girlfriend many years ago, very beautiful, and I thought the dance was going very well. And suddenly the head waiter came up to me and said, "Excuse me, sir, would you sit down so we can all watch?" So I feel a bit like that, being just in front of my old friend Sue Jaferge, whom you're all going to want to listen to. But I'd like to dedicate my speech to two fantastic Hungarian women. And also, my mother-in-law. I have to say that because I also should say, in case this is being filmed and it goes back to her, that she's also a great woman. So just get that right. Don't misquote me. Well, I first got to know Suja when I came here in 1991 to be director of the ILO office for Central and Eastern Europe. It was a very difficult period, as some of you will remember, from both a work point of view and a personal point of view, because not only was I being opposed by the new authorities and opposed by the World Bank and the IMF, but I was also being opposed by my own bureaucracy in the International Labour Organization back in Geneva, who didn't want us to succeed. And one of the wonderful things about that period of darkness for myself was my friendship with Suja Ferge. And we used to meet in the Musius Café, the Artist's Café, and used to have some wonderful discussions. And one in particular I'm going to relate this talk to. She may or may not remember. It reminds me of another quotation from Hegel. Hegel said, "My memory says I did that. My pride said I didn't. The memory fades." I am not sure if the idea I'm going to relate to came from Suja or myself or the mixture. But I think it came from the mixture, because that is the essence of intellectual development. We interact, and only by interacting do we move forward in our own thinking. Now I want to say a brief word about that other Hungarian woman who's 12 years older than Suja. And I was going to an event to celebrate her 85th anniversary. And coincidence. And I happened to meet my mother-in-law. And she said, and she happens to be exactly the same age as this Hungarian woman, by coincidence, she said to me, "When you meet her, tell her to give my stockings back." I said, "Well, beg your pardon?" And I said, "Do you know her?" And she said, "Not only do I know her, but after the war, we shared an apartment together. And one day she had a date, and I had the only pair of stockings. So she borrowed these black stockings to go on her date, and I've never had them back." So when I got to Montreal, and I was having dinner with Kerry Polanyi, I told her, I said, "Look, my mother-in-law says she wants her stockings back." And she indignantly said, "That's typical of her. That's typical. She never forgets." But it says something about these two Hungarian intellectual women. The great characteristic that I associate with them is not just their intellectual brilliance, but the fact that they are indomitable, combative, and realize that all of us, as human beings and as social scientists, must stay engaged socially, intellectually, and we must never give up hope. If we do that, we fail ourselves. That's what Suja Ferge and her generation stand for. Now, Suja was born 1931 and lived through the horror of the 30s. Being Jewish, her family suffered. She saw persecution and a terrifying period of human history. And one of the things people of her generation have learned and taught us is that we must never, never prejudice against people, persecute people of any sort, be it Jews, Roma, any other group, and today refugees. We must always fight that fight to stop persecution and social deprivation. Today in Hungary, you are seeing a government, you are seeing people doing things that will only lead to another horror. And it is a shame on all of us if we don't oppose them. But the 1930s was also the crisis of Karl Polanyi's great transformation. You will all remember that he had painted a picture of the development of capitalism through a disembedded phase in the 19th century, early part of the 20th century. You all know the stuff. But that disembedded phase had been led by financial capital and had provoked and increased the insecurity of millions and intensified inequality everywhere. And of course, that pursuit of laissez-faire, a market system, had led to a huge humanitarian crisis, which, in Polanyi's terms, led to the threat of the annihilation of civilization. Now, of course, he ushered in, and his model and his framework, a re-embedded phase after the Second World War. You in Hungary did not experience that. Your liberation in April 1945 ushered in a new horror, another sacrificing of freedom in the pursuit of what Suja and I had talked about in the cafe. Because both in Eastern Europe and in a different way in Western Europe, what happened in the post-war era was the pursuit of basic existential security at the sacrifice of ontological security. You remember now? Ontological security and ontological freedom is the ability to develop, the ability to develop our capabilities and our sense of freedom. In the Enlightenment traditions, and that is what social policy should be about, creating the institutions and the mechanisms to enable us to pursue what Hannah Arendt brilliantly conceived as associational freedom, republican freedom, the freedom to act in concert. And that is how we realize freedom. If you cannot act in concert, freedom is the freedom of the predator. It's the freedom of the opportunist, the criminal. Now, Polanyi's great transformation broke down in the 1970s and 1980s around the world, largely as a result of globalization and the collapse of Keynesian techniques. And what happened then is that a new dystopia opened up. A dystopia that we now call neoliberalism, led by the likes of Friedrich Hayek, Milton Friedman, the thinking of Ludwig von Mises, And we must remember that that model, which has dominated the world ever since, not only wanted liberalization of markets, the commodification of everything that could be commodified, privatization of everything, but also the systematic dismantling of every institution and mechanism of social solidarity. Because they stand against the market. So they must be torn apart. And you cannot understand neoliberalism without understanding that fundamental tenet of that. So we have been in the disembedded phase of the global transformation. And that global transformation has opened up new horrors. Horrors of growing inequality. Horrors of insecurity for millions and millions of people. In a sense, we have seen and we are seeing the loss of both existential security. People don't have basic security for their lives. And ontological security. There is no future in their dystopia except more consumption. If you can get away with it, don't pay your taxes. All the things that Adrian was so eloquently describing. And the functional distribution of income is growing worse and worse. We live in a second gilded age, but it's different from the first. In the first gilded age, Mark Twain described at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century, inequalities rose. But still, the emerging working class around the world saw real wages rise. In this second gilded age, where we see inequalities multiplying, real wages of the people I'm about to talk about have been falling and falling. And that leads to what I think is fundamental to social policy, and which I think it is a disgrace that many parts of our social science neglect today. And that is class has not gone away. We are seeing a new class structure, a globalized class structure taking shape. I've tried to write this in several books, which have been translated into many languages, but not yet Hungarian. I can understand why. But this new class fragmentation, at the top we have a plutocracy of the oligarchs. It's not the old form of inequality. These people are global citizens manipulating our politics, commodifying our politics, commodifying and degrading citizenship. They're criminals in all but name, and many of them are criminals in name. A long way below them, the old working class for which the welfare states were built, the proletariat, is disappearing. Disappearing. And beneath them, the precariat is taking shape. And this is the point on which I want you to join me and join Suja in being optimistic. I am fed up with us being pessimistic. We are not victims. Of course, things are dark. But we must never allow the darkness to crowd out our intellectual thinking. And the precariat can be defined in three Marxian terms. You don't have to be a Marxist to understand that. The precariat has distinctive relations of production. It's being habituated to internalize and accept a life of unstable labor, unstable living, without an ontological capability to develop themselves in occupational terms. I am becoming something. I am something. If you're in the precariat, you can't say that. The second distinctive feature is that people in the precariat have to rely almost entirely on money wages without access to all those social benefits at enterprise level and at state level that we came to regard as a 20th century achievement. And that means that the volatility of wages means that they're living on the edge of unsustainable debt all the time. The indebtedness is a structural feature of this neoliberal dystopia. It's not an incidental thing. And when they have austerity, it's not about getting rid of debt. It's about transferring public debt onto private people and the insecurities that go with that, so that they can cut the taxes and do the subsidies for the plutocrats and the elite and the corporate plutocracy. It's a very clever game, but we allow them to be clever. It's our fault. Now, the third thing is something that all the translators have written to me. All of them said, we're sorry, we don't understand this word. The third is that the precariat has distinctive relations to the state. Not to government, to the state. And in the process, they are becoming what we call in English denizens. That's the word. It can't be translated. A denizen is a medieval British concept which referred to people who, when they went into a town, were given a more limited range of rights than the citizens of the town. Today, we are seeing millions and millions of people, not just refugees and migrants, being converted from citizens into denizens, losing the five great rights, often without knowing it. And in the end, the most decisive feature of being in the precariat is that you are a supplicant. You have no rights. You have to beg some figure of authority to give you something, to show pity on you. This is an undignified way of running a society, but that is what is happening. But the precariat is only a class in the making. At the moment, it is internally divided, and I've tried to trace that in the books, into atavists, people who are falling out of old working class communities and traditions. They don't have a lot of education. And they listen to the sirens of neo-fascist populists, playing on the fears and the insecurities and blaming others. You see it in your own country. I don't want to mention the names. But you're seeing it in the United States today with Donald Trump, a jackass, a billionaire, who does know nothing of social policy. And yet millions of people are voting for him, and don't be thinking it's only Americans. A lot of other people are also saying, we need a Donald Trump. It's a terrifying thought. Next year we will see Marine Le Pen being pegged as the new great hope of the atavists. But there is another part of the precariat. And this is the group that I find myself being invited to address, be it in Italy, in Spain, in Sweden, in Japan. It's the progressives who went to university, went to college, and they were promised a career. They were promised a future. They were promised that ontological security. And they come out and they know they bought a lottery ticket. And that lottery ticket costs more and more and more, and is worth less and less. They are denied a future. And this group is not stupid enough to go to the far right. They are looking for a new progressive politics. What I call in my book, with apologies to Dante, a politics of paradise. And it's partly our responsibility, if we call ourselves thinkers, to contribute in a small way to the revival of a progressive politics. Now, when I wrote my book, The Precariat, I was sitting in the kitchen not with my mother-in-law. I was sitting in the kitchen making dinner, and the phone went. And a man's voice at the other end said, "My name's Noam Chomsky." I said, So I thought, which of my friends was pulling my leg, you know, making a joke? He said, "I really read your book, said some very nice things, very complimentary." And I said, "Thank you very much, thank you. Yes, I'll call you back on Monday." Because I thought it was a friend pulling, doing it. So I had to call him back on the Monday, and it was him. I said, "I'm awfully sorry, blah, blah, blah." And I got to talking, and I said, "Listen, next year, 2015, will be the 800th anniversary of the foundation document of our constitutions, Europe and North America. It actually only became the Magna Carta in 1217, but we don't need to go into that. The Magna Carta was the first class-based set of demands made against the state. That's the importance. And rights and new forward marches only start with demands. Then they become rights. So I said, supposing in a wild moment, I would think, what would a precariat charter look like in 2015? And how would it differ from what a proletariat charter would have looked like in 1915? Well, let me tell you, you need to have some stiff drinks, perhaps something stronger, some good sex, whatever you want, to start that process, because you have to have a certain arrogance. But I've been listening to many audiences, well over 300, on the precariat, and I drew up a set of demands that go into the precariat charter. And it's up to us to devise a sense of the future. And why I've always loved Suger, and I've loved Kerry as well, and my mother-in-law, why I've loved them is they've always stood up for us, looking for the future. We must do that. And you have not finished your work. You have many years to fight it. And I've told Kerry this, even though she's nearly blind now. We still have to continue. And one of the things that I've been arguing for, and Suja knows this, for the last 30 years, is that we move towards a society where everybody has a basic income. A basic income as a right. A basic income that can be an anchor. That give us that basic security and the capability to imagine an ontological freedom. And remarkably, after I was fired from the ILO for the second time or something like that, I began working with the Self-Employed Women's Association of India. And I gave a lecture on basic income one day, and these leaders said, "Why don't we do a pilot in India?" And we've done a pilot with 6,000 people, given a basic income. And Sonia Gandhi called us to her house before we launched it. She said, "You're wasting all that money. They were wasted on alcohol and tobacco and bads." I said, "What do you mean? How do you know that?" And 2 years later, she asked us to her house again to present the results. And at the end, she just said, "I wish I'd known before. People who have basic security become better people. They work more, not less. They become more tolerant of other people, more altruistic." And one of the things that we found, and I've written about it because I get tears in my eyes, is that the emancipatory value of a basic income is greater than the money value. It enables people to take control of their lives, inducing them to become more community oriented, which has multiplier effects socially and economically. I believe a basic income is part of a progressive future. Delighted that Suja thinks the same. And I believe it's not a panacea, but it must become part of the new social progressive policy. And in that context, I'd like to conclude by referring to not my mother-in-law, but to a great poet who wrote one of the most magnificent poems in the English language. It was Shelley. Those of you who know The Mask of Anarchy, he wrote after the Occupy movement in Manchester, where people were butchered by the police. He wrote this poem, which sums up your spirit. And the final stanza goes like this, and I hope it can be translated, but I'm sure many of you know it. Rise like lions after slumber, in unvanquishable number. Shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep had fallen on you. Ye are many, they are few. Thank you very much.